Hey there, and thanks for venturing beyond the Rotunda, a Farmingdale Public Library podcast, where we often talk about literature, history, and community. But sometimes we'll discuss things like, what are your 2025 New Year's resolutions? I am your narrator, Kevin Schultz. Let's ring this one in. This is episode 6 of the Beyond the Rotunda podcast, a production of the Farmingdale Public Library, where we are more than just books. I want to wish everyone a very happy and healthy new year, and may 2025 bring for all of us truth, justice, and a better tomorrow. And for those who are not aware, since 2021, that has been the catchphrase for DC Comics' Superman. And today, I will be speaking with former writer and editor from DC Comics, Bob Rozakis, who, in his 25-plus years, worked in several different capacities, from editorial assistant to executive production manager. It was a fun and interesting conversation, going through some of the history from both DC Comics and comics in general. But before we get to our interview, let's check out our very first cover question of 2025. And what else could it be but what are your New Year's resolutions? For me, my resolution has always been the same over the past 8 years. My mother, Patricia, passed away after a 17-year battle with cancer on New Year's Day in 2017. My mother had always been one of my great supporters. She wanted me to improve and progress my life forward. So from that point forward, my New Year's resolution in honor of my mother has been to improve on at least one aspect of my life over the previous year. Now, I don't pick the aspect. I try to improve on everything in my life. And at the end of the year, I reassess. And as long as I have improved on one aspect, I have achieved my goal. So for example, in 2021, I improved my family status by getting married. In 2022, I upgraded my living situation when I moved back to Farmingdale. In 2023, I upgraded my professional outlook by learning the new skill of navigating a computer using a screen reader. And in 2024, I improved my financial situation when I secured the job here at the Farmingdale Library. So we'll see what 2025 holds in store for me. Now that's what's in my book. Let's find out what's in yours. Donna from Farmingdale says she doesn't do New Year's resolutions. If you want to set a goal for yourself, why wait for the new year? Do it right away. Donna, I get that the new year brings new beginnings, and that's a great place to start. But I do understand your point of view. Why must we wait for the new year? Start right away. Laura from Plainview says she wants to improve herself, both mind and body. And Laura, I wish you the best of luck with that. Jack from Plainview says his New Year's resolution is to reduce the amount of fast foods that he eats, possibly going down to only once a week. Jack, that is a great resolution. I would suggest replacing the fast food with a new and different food each week. Good luck with it. Shannon, also from Plainview, says her resolution is to slim down in 2025 by trying to exercise more, which will be a challenge since she has cerebral palsy. Shannon, this is an excellent resolution. I have faith that you can overcome your challenges and achieve your goal. Don't quit. Finally, we have Serena from Colorado. Shout out to the Centennial State. And Serena says her resolution is to read 25 books in 2025. And Serena, since this is a library podcast, I think this one is awesome. Maybe some of those reads could be from books you heard about on this very podcast. I thank everyone for participating, and I wish you all good luck with your resolutions. Remember, you can reach out to me by emailing me at beyondtherotunda@farmingdalelibrary.org, or follow me on Facebook and Instagram by searching Kevin Schultz BTR. And now let's turn the page to our interview with Bob Rozakis, where you will quickly understand why he was known as the Answer Man for DC Comics. Enjoy! We are here with retired writer and editor from DC Comics, Bob Rozakis, who has written over 400 DC stories, hundreds of letter columns, and 2 years of the Superman Sunday comic strip. Bob Rozakis, thank you for venturing beyond the rotunda.
It's a pleasure to be here.
As I always like to do, I start off by giving our guest the opportunity to answer our cover question. And since this episode is dropping right after the new year, our cover question is, do you have any 2025 New Year's resolutions?
I would say my resolution is to be able to do everything that I was still doing in 2024.
That's a good one. Status quo.
Yeah. When you get to be 73 years old, you realize, well, I can't do that anymore.
Right. So before you check that off the list, you relish in it.
Exactly.
Now, growing up, I wasn't a big comics kid, but 8-year-old Kevin did find one superhero very cool, and that was the Flash.
Okay.
Which comics were you pulling off the shelf as a youth?
Superman and then Batman and then the Justice League and then the members of the Justice League. So Flash and Green Lantern.
Right.
But I started out actually reading Felix the Cat and Casper the Friendly Ghost and then discovered Superman and became a Superman and superhero fan.
How old were you when you got into Superman?
It was 1958, so I was 7 years old.
Okay, that's about the right age.
So I still have that first Superman comic that I bought.
Oh, that's very cool. Mm-hmm. That's probably got some value.
Well, it's been beat up because it was read many, many, many times.
Right.
So, you know, people think that, oh, I have an old comic, it's got to be worth millions of dollars. And it's like, well, unless it's one of the key issues of something and it's in really good condition, you know.
Covered in plastic, right?
Yeah.
So tell us how you got hired by DC Comics.
I actually was what we call a letter hack. I wrote letters to the editor all the time and had them published in the comics. And so they were appearing fairly regularly. I had 100 and some odd letters published over the course of about 4 years and thought it would be neat to go in and visit the DC offices. And so I called up Julius Schwartz, who was one of the editors and particularly the editor who ran a lot of my letters. And so I called the DC offices and asked to speak to him. And I figured this is going to be like you call the White House and ask to talk to the president. And, you know, you don't get the president, you get three secretaries. And so I called and I get the switchboard and I asked for Julie. And then he answers the phone. And so it was like, oh. And so I told him who I was and he recognized the name. And I said, I'd like to come in and visit the office. And he said, sure. And we set up a time. And at the time, I was making up some crossword puzzles for a fanzine. And I thought that Nelson Bridwell, who was one of the other editors, who was also an expert on comic book trivia, would get a kick out of them. So I brought them along.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, Nelson shared an office with Julie. And so we were sitting there and Julie got a phone call and I pulled out the puzzles and I handed them to Nelson. And I said, I think you'll like doing these. And Julie hung up the phone and looked and grabbed them and said, what's that? And I explained what they were. And he said, stay right here. And I was like, well, I'm not going to go anywhere. He ran out of the office. He comes back a couple minutes later with Sol Harrison, who was then the vice president of the company. And Saul said, "You made these puzzles up?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Could you make up ones just about Superman and just about Batman?" And I said, "Sure." He said, "Okay, you make them up, we'll buy them." And I was like,
Wow.
"Okay." And
Yeah.
so I became a DC Comics freelancer, and I got paid the whopping sum of $15 a page. And it wasn't just making up the puzzle. I had to actually do the grid and using press type numbers and letters, put the everything in. The
Right.
only thing they did was set the actual type to paste in on the page, but everything else I did. And, looking back at it now, there was an awful lot of work for $15.
Yes, it sounds like it.
But so I was a senior at Hofstra at the time. And so I did three Superman puzzles, three Batmans, and three Justice Leagues. And about a month later, I get a call, and it's Saul's secretary. And she says, "Saul needs to talk to you right away." And I was like, "Okay." And he gets on the phone. He says, "What do you know about Tarzan?" And at the time, I had been binging through all of Edgar Rice Burroughs, so I knew quite a bit about him. I said, "Yeah, I know quite a bit." He says, "I need three puzzles on Monday." And I said, "Okay."
What else are you going
Yeah, exactly. So this was, I think, a Friday afternoon, and so I spent the weekend doing a 3 pages of Tarzan puzzles, and they were actually the first ones that were published. They were doing an oversized Tarzan Treasury, and they wanted some feature pages in it, and so they had three of my puzzles in there. And then I graduated from Hofstra with a degree in accounting, and just as a lark, said maybe I can get a job at DC instead. So I got a job and working as an assistant editor. And that first summer, Saul had this idea that the newsstand distribution of comics was starting to fall apart. And there were no comic shops at this point. So there were whole areas where there was no access to comic books. And so he came up with the idea of the comic mobile, which was like the Mr. Softee truck, except we were selling comic books.
That actually was my next question. I was going to ask you to explain that, so go
Okay.
ahead.
So, Michael Uslan, who is now the executive producer of all things Batman in the movies and TV, was working as an editorial assistant at DC that summer, and he drove the comic mobile first. He lived in Central Jersey, and so he had it for about 6 weeks, and he had to go back to Indiana University. He was only a junior, so he was only at DC for the summer. And so Saul decided that, okay, we're going to move it from Central Jersey. You'll do it on Long Island. And we started going through the procedures of getting permits and licenses and everything else. And each town in Nassau and Suffolk has its own set of licenses and
Of course.
permits and everything else. So I ended up, I think I got Hempstead, North Hempstead, Oyster Bay, and Huntington, so that I had a wide enough area. And Michael in New Jersey was able to go to the beaches and the parks and the schools and wherever there were kids. And he could go into a parking lot at the beach and just set up and, as kids came by, sell stuff. In Nassau and Suffolk, you can't do that. Basically, I was prohibited from going to the beaches, the parks, the schools, or anywhere else where there might be people.
Your
Uh,
prime
so I was
demographic.
limited to driving up and down the street like the Mr. Softee. And since this was a rented van, we had no speakers built into it or bells attached. And so I would hang my arm out the window ringing these bells, and kids would come out looking to buy creamsicles, and I was selling comic books. So that lasted, I did it, I guess, 6 weeks until school started. And then there were no kids to come outside. And the comic mobile was then sent to a comics dealer down in New Mexico, where it unfortunately had a close encounter with a semi.
Oh
Yeah, well,
no.
he was okay. The comic mobile was gone forever. But it was a very interesting period because Michael and I were able to put together all sorts of analysis based on what the kids liked And we came up with like a 25-page report of, well, this sold and that didn't. They like this, they don't like
Right.
that. We found out that they really like dinosaurs.
Right.
And so, any comic that had a dinosaur on the cover, the kids would be buying that. And
Okay.
that the girls liked the scary comics more than the boys did.
Wow.
So, it was a whole variety of things. And actually, some of the stuff that we gave them the information on affected how they, what they came up with as
Yeah.
new books.
So you were building the algorithm.
Yeah.
That's very fascinating.
Yeah. So then I came back to work in the office as an assistant editor to Julie, and was an assistant editor and briefly an editor, and then moved into the production department as assistant production manager.
So I understand there are gold, silver, and bronze eras of DC Comics. Can you explain those
Yes,
to us?
sure. The Golden Age was the beginning.
Okay.
From the basically the first comic books were created by Max Gaines. He was a sales promotion salesman, and basically he would come up with products, that they would give away something if you bought something else.
Okay.
And he came up with the idea of taking reprints of comic strips and putting them together in a book, a magazine is of 64 pages and a
Right.
cover. And if you sent in two labels from Ivory Soap, you got this free magazine.
Right.
And so he had all these copies, and he decided, would this sell? And so he slapped a 10-cent price sticker on them and took them to newsstands in his neighborhood and said, see if these sell. And he came back the following week, and they were all gone. And the news dealers was like, we need more of these. And so basically what he did was invent the comic book. So the first actual comic book was called Famous Funnies. It was reprints of newspaper strips from the time. And a couple of other publishers got into the business. They said, oh, this is good. And then there was a man named Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson, and he had access to both printing and paper and wanted to get into the business, but there were really no popular strips left to reprint that he, so
Right.
he had, he came, he said, all right, I've got to come up with new material. And so his first magazine was called New Fun Comics, and all of the strips were just like one or two pages. They were set up to look like they were newspaper strips, except
Okay.
this was all new material. And so his company, National Allied Publications, which eventually became DC Comics, he published New Fun and then turned that into More Fun Comics, then New Comics, which became New Adventure Comics, and then Detective Comics, which was the first one that was devoted to a single genre.
Right. And that's
And it
why
was all,
DC is
yeah, and the
DC,
DC
right?
comes from Detective Comics. And then in 1938, they were starting a new comic called Action Comics. And they were looking around for what to feature in it. And two young guys, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, had already been working for them and were doing strips for the other three magazines. And they had come up with this costumed character that they tried to sell as a newspaper strip unsuccessfully for 4 years.
Right.
And one of the editors remembered seeing it and said, well, how about this? And said to Siegel and Shuster, cut it apart because it was set up as, daily newspaper strips, and reconfigure it into the page size format for the comic books. And, we'll use it, and you'll have a new regular feature to do. And so they did that. And the first story was 13 pages. They were paid $10 a page, which was substantial considering I got 15,
Right,
40 years later. And the way comics worked at that point is that you signed away the rights to everything when you signed the back of the check. And so effectively they signed away the rights to Superman for that $130 check.
wow, who knew?
Well, a lot of people claimed they knew, but they didn't really, because Superman appeared on the cover of the first issue of Action Comics and did not appear again on the cover until number seven. So nobody was
Wow.
sure,
Nobody, right.
oh, this is going to be a big hit. And I've pointed out, I teach a class at Farmingdale College in comics and graphic novels, and I always point out the fact that Siegel and Shuster created other characters before that. And they signed away the rights to those characters at the same way they signed away the rights to Superman. Had
Right.
one of them become a big hit, it would have been the same situation.
Right.
So, but it turned out that superheroes in costumes were popular, and that was really the beginning of the golden age of comics.
Okay.
And superheroes went from being a minor thing in 1938. By 1941, more than half the comics being published featured costume characters.
And you think there was a correlation with the war that was going on?
Sure, it was part of it, yeah, that
Yeah.
the whole concept of we need somebody to, be our hero.
Right.
After the war, the sales started to fall off, and the superheroes lost their popularity. The publishers started going into other genres, including romance and westerns. And now that the war was over, there were war comics, science fiction, and then horror and crime comics, which were the two bugaboos for the industry in the early 50s.
Right.
But the Golden Age basically ended somewhere between 1952 and 1956.
Okay. And then the
And
silver.
the Silver Age began with everybody pretty much acknowledges that the recreation of the Flash in 1956 is the beginning of the Silver Age.
That's my boy.
Because,
Okay.
yeah, so that's where the superheroes started gaining traction again. And again, it took 6 months to get sales reports on an issue. And
Okay.
so DC did one issue of The Flash in a book called Showcase, which every issue was something new and different, and they were looking for things to do. And it was Julie Schwartz who, when it was his turn to come up with something, said, "I want to, redo The Flash." And at the time, the only superheroes that were still being published were Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman. And
Okay.
Superman, far and away, was the biggest, most popular one. There was
Right.
the Adventures of Superman was on TV
Right.
at the time with George Reeves, and so there
Right.
was the audience for that. And so they did the one issue of Showcase in the Flash with the Flash, and then 8 months later did a second one, and then 8 months after that did a third one. And then so it was 2.5 years after the first appearance of the Flash in Showcase that he finally got his own comic book.
Wow.
So the Silver Age, yeah, it started with this one issue over here, but it really didn't take off until 2.5 years later.
Right.
So, but then Julie introduced the new Green Lantern and Hawkman and the Atom and a new Justice Society, which was now the Justice League. And Martin Goodman, who was the publisher, owner and publisher of what was then Atlas Comics, which had started out as Timely Comics, he had published Captain America and Submariner and the Human Torch and a whole
Okay.
variety of superheroes back in World War II. Stan Lee was his editor and head writer, and Goodman found out that Justice League was selling really well. And at the time, Marvel, they weren't Marvel yet, they were still Atlas,
Right.
was they were publishing giant monster comics and war comics and westerns. They had no superheroes. And Goodman came back and said to Stan, "DC's making a lot of money on superheroes, teams of superheroes. We need a team of superheroes."
Right.
And so Stan and Jack Kirby came up with the Fantastic Four,
Right. And the rest is history.
and the rest is history. From there, it was the Incredible Hulk, and then Spider-Man, and then Ant-Man, and Iron Man,
Right.
and they brought back Captain America. And so that was the Marvel revolution in the early 60s. But again, it took 6 months to get sales reports. And
Right.
so Spider-Man was actually introduced in the last issue of Amazing Fantasy. And Goodman really didn't like the concept of the character when Stan told him he wanted to do this Spider-Man book. And Goodman said, "Nobody likes spiders." And so Stan knew it was the last issue, and he's like, "What the hell? We're putting him in here. We're putting him on the cover." And then the sales reports came in, and 6 months later, and Goodman's like, "Yeah, we need this Spider-Man character."
You're right.
So you know, then they came out with Spider-Man in his own book. But so the Silver Age ran from basically the mid 50s until the just about 1970. And a couple of things that moved us from the Silver Age to the Bronze Age were Jack Kirby left Marvel and went to DC in 1970. He felt that he was not getting his fair credit for the amount of work he was doing,
Right.
particularly with the creation of the characters, and that Stan was taking all the credit. And Jack had lots of other ideas he wanted to introduce and just didn't want to give them to Stan to take credit for. And so he moved over to DC. The other major thing that happened is the second generation of comic book people came in. And I was one of those. We were
Right.
the people who grew up reading the comics and were comic book
Right.
fans. You know, the first generation, this was a job. Many of them didn't want people to know that they were doing comic
Right.
books, but that it was their occupation. They you know, did their writing or their artwork, and you know, that was their 9 to 5 job. We came in and we were fans, and you know, we had a whole idea of you know, the continuity. And you know, oh, wait a minute, you said this Superman couldn't do this, or Superman could do this back then, and now you're saying he can't, or you know, vice versa. And so the generation of fanboys came in, and that precipitated really the Bronze Age.
Right.
So
And that's when you worked.
that's when I came in. Yeah,
Right.
I started working at DC in 1973.
Okay. Are there any other ages after, or do we end at the Bronze? We're still going.
Basically, we the from 1986 on, when DC published Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns, and the comics became much more adult and grim,
Right.
that was the beginning of the Dark Age.
Okay.
And from that point, I mean, we killed Superman, Batman got his back broken, Green Lantern went crazy and killed the entire Green Lantern Corps. You know, it was like, okay, what else can we do to these guys, kind of thing. And that the Dark Age pretty much lasted into the early 00s, and nobody's come up with a name for the current age.
Okay.
But you know, it could be the digital age, it could be the reboot age, it could be the lots of money age. I mean,
Right.
Disney paid, you know, $4 billion to buy Marvel.
Yeah.
You know, so and you know, DC has been a part of Warner for since back in 1967. So, you
Right.
know, as Paul Levitz, who was one of my cohorts and eventually became president of the company, used to refer to us, we were the little toe on the giant Time Warner monster. You know, there would be people who say, "We own a comic book company?" It's like, yeah, you own the one that has Superman and Batman. Yeah.
So, from your time at DC, take us through the process of putting together a comic book, from storyline to illustration to publication.
Okay. Well, the traditional way, and it's changed over the years as more and more artists have become writers as well, and teams of writers and artists start to work differently. But the traditional way was that the editor and the writer would sit down and come up with a plot for the story. Okay. And I mean, that's the way I started doing them, working with Julie. It would be, okay, you're going to do a Robin story, or you're going to do a Superman story, or you're going to do whatever, a Superboy, whatever. And you've got 8 pages, or you've got 6 pages, or you've got 12, or you've got 22, whatever it is.
Okay.
And you know, the more pages you had with Julie, the more complex the plot better be.
Right.
So It would, you know, come in with an idea and then hammer out the plot. And then the writer would go home and actually write the script. And the script would be panel by panel, basically telling the artist what to draw in this particular panel with the dialogue, captions, whatever else was part of the panel, and laid out from beginning to end. And then that would come back and the editor would go through it and he'd make changes if he wanted to. Julie sometimes would be heavily editing things, and other times would be like, it's good, it's fine. Then it would go to a penciler. That would be the first artist, and he would actually follow the instructions, lay out the pages, draw everything. Then the letterer got it, and the letterer would put in all of the word balloons, the captions, the sound effects, etc. And then it would go to an inker. And the inker's job basically was to ink over in with Black India ink all of the artwork and erase.
Like outline it.
Well, basically go over it and make it permanent, where the penciler could be redone. And we had some inkers who would actually redraw what the pencilers did, depending on how good the penciler was versus how good the inker was. And then erase everything. And then they would make a photostat of it, and that would get colored. And the color separations at the time, comic books were limited to 25% dot, a 50% dot, and a 100% solid of red, yellow, and blue, which gave you potentially 64 combinations. And of those 64, there were probably about 15 or 20 that were too dark and muddy to use in the comic books because you had newsprint and a heavy saturation of ink. So the colorist would then, with his limited palette or her limited palette, do the color guides, and from that they would do the color separations and create the printing plates. So over the course of that whole procedure took pretty much 6 months. So from the time the editor sat down with the writer to plot the story till the time the printed comic book came out was 5 to 6 months. So in the middle of July, we'd be writing Christmas stories. And in the dead of winter, we'd be writing stories that took place at, you know, on a hot summer day.
And what's the publication of that then? Like, how does it get into the book?
Oh, at that point, once the set color separations were done, it was sent to the printing plant. And at that time, all of the comics were being printed in a printing plant in Sparta, Illinois, which was out in the middle of nowhere in Illinois. And it was the center of the country, though, so it made it perfect for distribution because it was the same distance to California as it was to New York.
Makes sense.
So, yeah.
Now, how different do you think that is now since you've left the industry to what it was then?
Well, a lot of the stuff is being done on computer now. There are artists who create everything on a computer rather than on a piece of paper. As I said, there are a lot more writer artists create the whole story and are writing it as they're drawing it, kind of thing. Even as over the years when I was writing them, if it was an artist that I worked with regularly, rather than do a formal breakdown of panel by panel, I would just give him an outline and say, this is what's going to happen on this page. You decide, you know, how to lay it out. This is what's happening on this page. You can do it in four panels, you can do it in 12 panels, whatever works. And then I would write the dialogue after I saw the pages.
That's
So, but I'd
interesting.
give them, you know, even an outline of here's what they're talking about. So, you know, don't have somebody punching the other guy in the face if they're having a discussion about, you know, let's be good pals. So.
So you have created several different characters. So let's talk about a few of them.
Okay.
Explain Amazing Man.
Amazing Man was actually, I worked on that with an artist named Stephen DeStefano. And Stephen, when he was 12 years old, started writing letters to DC,
Wow.
and particularly to me. And he would write me these long handwritten pages on loose leaf, letters on loose leaf paper.
Right.
And on the back, on the end of each one, he would draw a cartoon. And I said, this kid's got talent. I mean, this is a 12-year-old kid. And so when he was 16, I got him a summer internship at DC. And as he likes to say, he learned the fine art of Xeroxing, because that's basically what the interns did. It's like, make copies of this, make copies of that.
Right.
But he used the opportunity as well to not only work on his artwork, but to bring it into the editors and get pointers from the editors. You know, this is good. That's the, and he
Right.
came up with the basic idea of the characters of Amazing Man.
Okay.
And he said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Well, I think if we put this together, we can you know, come up with something that DC will be interested in." And basically, Amazing Man is a situation comedy, not unlike Friends. You know, before Friends was on the air,
Right.
we have this these six people living in an apartment building in Queens, and you know, we even had the dopey Italian guy. So, but we had a guy who wore a helmet and thought he was a superhero, and another guy who looked like a dog. But you know, so it was really just kind of a change of pace from the superheroes and everything else, because you know, other than wearing a helmet, Amazing Man had no powers. To you know, would run around, you know, preventing kids from eating cigarette butts on the sidewalk. You know,
Right.
that was his superpower, so, or his
Well,
superheroics.
that leads me to my question. So, as you said, Amazing Man didn't have superpowers. So, what makes a superhero? Is it the super ability or is it the actions of the individual?
I would say it has to be the actions of the individual, because you have a number of superheroes who don't have powers. You know, their powers come from their weapons or their suits. Or Iron Man is, you know, Tony Stark does not have any superpowers. Bruce Wayne
Right.
doesn't have any superpowers.
Right.
You know, Superman, on the other hand, has
Yep.
powers.
Explain this one I like a lot. Explain Mr. E.
The idea of Mr. E was, at the time, DC was publishing a number of what we called mystery titles, and these were the after the horror comics were basically banned in the 1950s, they became much more tame, and so you had ghosts and things like that rather than blood sucking creatures and gouging eyeballs and things like that. But at the time, DC was looking to have a character in each one of the mystery magazines they were doing.
Okay.
And so Jack Harris, who was the editor, came to me and he said, you know, look, come up with something. And we went back and forth. And I just liked the idea of a guy who was blind but could see evil, as you know, we put it. He could see the evil in people. And set him up in Boston, which was a prime place for the witches of Salem and that kind of, you know, that
Right.
whole, you know, magical. So we had a vampire and we had a werewolf and we had hellhounds, or as I called them, every time I referred to them, the devil dogs.
Right.
And it was just a series of they. I think most of the stories were just like 8 pages, but each one would focus on something that was mysterious and you know, somewhat supernatural. And then Jack left the company, and a new editor took over the book, and he said, "I don't like the character." And that was the end of Mr. E.
So, how long did it run?
A year, a little over a year, I think, 12 or 13 stories.
As a blind individual myself, I was thrilled when I found out that you created a blind character. And you touched on it a little bit, but like, what was the motivation to that?
Just something different.
Right.
You know, And it was funny too, because we had the character and we had the setup and everything, and the only thing we didn't have was a name. And it was like, geez, what are we gonna call him? And then we came up with all sorts of different names. And then I was home, and I don't even remember what I was doing at the time, but all of a sudden I said, Mr. E. And I called Jack at home. I said, Mr. E. And he said, that's it.
I love it. It sounds like mystery. It makes perfect
Yeah.
sense.
Well, that was the whole thing. It was,
Right.
you know, like, all right.
Yeah.
So.
Is it possible to still find those? Because I never got a chance to read those.
Yeah, they're out there somewhere. They're
They're out
in
there.
the book was called Secrets of Haunted House.
Okay.
And I think it was issues like 31 to 42 or something like that. Somewhere
I'm gonna
around
have to look
that.
for it. Yeah. What was the Hero Hotline all about?
Hero Hotline, I like to refer to as Hill Street Blues with costumes.
Okay.
The basic concept was that if you had something that needed a superhero to solve, but it wasn't earth-shattering, so you weren't going to get Superman, you
Right.
could call this 800 number and they would dispatch somebody who could solve your problem. And so I had a Plastic Man type character whose name was Stretch, who was always complaining because all he ever got sent out for was cats stuck in trees.
Okay.
I had a character who had all sorts of vision things. He had all sorts of gizmos on his eyes, and he was called Private Eyes. And so he'd be sent out, oh, I lost my diamond ring somewhere in the house, and he would use his different lenses and things and find stuff. But it was basically done as a superhero book, but with a very humorous
Yeah.
twist. There were some bigger things going on, but the majority was focused on the characters and the different powers that they had and the different things they had to confront. I mean, it was, you know, somebody who was holding up a bodega, things like that. It was
Right.
nothing major.
Right. A lot of your work has a comedic slant to it. And obviously that's intentional, but was there an edict to that, or
No, it's
it's
just
just
the way I like to write the stories.
right?
So I always felt that, you know, you need some entertainment in it.
Sure.
I remember doing one Superman story where somehow everything got magnetized and this woman's pocketbook was around her shoulder and it got stuck to the car because of the clasp and the strap and whatever, the buckle on the
Right.
strap, and she couldn't get free. And Superman comes and he uses his heat vision and just melts through the strap.
Right.
And so she starts yelling at him, "You've ruined my pocketbook." It's like, you know, it was a throwaway bit, you know, it was like two panels, but it was like, yeah, this is what would happen. You know, not
Right.
everybody's happy that you came in and, you know, the way you solved the problem. So,
Who is Dwella Dent?
Dwella Dent, the Joker's daughter. I was writing Robin stories, and Dick Grayson at the time was a student at Hudson University. And actually, the Robin stories were the first ones that I started writing. I had proposed some Superman stories to Julie, and he didn't like the ideas I came up with. And he said, "Well, Robin, Dick Grayson's in college. You just graduated from college. Write college stories about Dick Grayson." And so I had written a half a dozen or so Robin stories, and we decided we needed to come up with a villain for a regular villain for Robin. And so it came up with the idea of Dwella Dent, who in the first one is disguised as the Joker's daughter and then comes back as Catwoman's daughter and then comes back as the Riddler's daughter and the Penguin's daughter. And as it turned out, when we got to the end, she was actually Two-Face's daughter.
Right.
But so she was a regularly appearing villain in the Robin stories, and then I liked her so much we turned her into a heroine and put her in Teen Titans.
Yeah. How'd that switch come to be?
It was just like the readers seemed to like the character, I liked the character, and we went back and I said, you know, she never really committed any crimes. You know, she was doing things basically because she wanted to vex Robin.
Right.
And so she could kind of still become a hero. And if there was anything in there, we're just going to forget that she did, oh, she did actually steal this, or she did
Right.
actually do that. Nah, it was, everything was, everybody was happy in the end.
I've heard some say that she is the precursor to Harley Quinn. Do you believe with that? You agree with
I
that?
do believe that, yes. No one who created Harley Quinn will ever acknowledge it, but yeah.
Right. The
So,
comparisons are there, yeah.
and they did the Gotham Knights show that was on CW, I guess now 2 years ago. She was the main character in there, and
I
I
didn't
thought they
realize
did a
that.
nice job with her, including how they worked out that she was Harvey Dent's daughter.
Right.
So,
Now, of all the characters you have created, do you have a favorite?
probably, I think Hero Hotline, because I think that
Oh.
was the most fun because I got to create all of the characters. And this was, I worked with Stephen DeStefano was the artist on Hero Hotline as well.
Okay.
And so it was kind of, when we did Amazing Man, it was he came up with the initial concept and I fleshed it all out. And then I came up with the initial concept for Hero Hotline and he designed the characters. And, so it was like, okay, we got a character that does this. And he would come up with, the looks. And then he would start adding background characters. He says, well, there's got to be more people working there. And so we had one that he just had this turtle that I said, what is it? He said, oh, that's Marie, the talking turtle. I said, well, what power? He says, don't worry about it. She's just going to wander through now and then. And he came up with Zeep, the living sponge. And, it was like, oh, if there's an acid spill, they send Zeep and he soaks it all up.
That's funny.
So he would just throw characters in the background and be like, what is that? And he's, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. And
It'll
we
make
actually
sense
came up with the,
eventually.
yeah, I said, we came up with the whole idea if we could have a whole concept of the Night Crew and it would be all these other characters that he had wandering through would now be the guys that worked at night because our characters worked 9 to 5.
That's funny. I love
So,
that
yeah.
concept. Did you find it more enjoyable to write the heroes or the villains?
The heroes. I mean, the villains, you had to come up with something specific for them to do. Whereas the heroes, it was like, okay, I can go pretty much anywhere. And there would be things that would inspire, the idea for a story. I don't know if you're familiar with the town of Centralia in Pennsylvania.
No.
It's a town in the eight was the town basically was built over a coal mine. It's
Okay.
in the middle of Pennsylvania, hence the name Centralia. And in 1956, there was a fire in the coal mine. And the fire is still burning because
Wow.
there's an unlimited amount of fuel down there.
Yeah, makes
And I
sense.
read about Centralia in a magazine, news magazine at one point in I guess it was the early 80s. And so I put this bit in a Superman story where Superman goes to Coal Town, Pennsylvania, and puts out the fire. A reporter in a nearby town in Pennsylvania saw this story and tracked me down to ask me, how I came up with this idea. And I just, well, I read about it and I decided, it would be an interesting, bit for Superman to do. It ended up on the front page of the local newspaper that Superman saves Centralia with the first page of the story of Superman arriving in the town. And by this point, about half of the residents had moved out. I mean, the ground was there was spots where the smoke was coming out of the ground, but the ground was perpetually warm.
Right.
So it would snow and the snow would all melt. And I got a letter from the mayor of the town. It was a woman, Anne Marie Devine, Mary Ann Devine, something like that. And she sent a certificate to me and to Kurt Schaffenberger, who was the artist who drew the story. And we were made honorary residents of Centralia for having saved the town. And so I actually went to visit Centralia because I was going to do a follow-up where they decide that, now that he's put out the fire, they make a statue of Superman out of coal and
Okay.
to celebrate the fact that he saved the town. And in this the second story, I used the reporter who originally tracked me down and the mayor of the town and a couple of other people, but actually went and took photographs so Kurt Schaffenberger could actually draw things that were actually in the town. So we did the second story. And again, it wasn't the full thing of the story. It was a two-page sequence in a much longer story. And since then, the town has been totally abandoned because it became too toxic for people to live in. And actually, the road that leads into town, there is just it's just the road ends and there's a pile of debris piled up so that you can't
You
go any
can't.
further without going by foot. But the town is totally abandoned now, and the fire continues to burn down under the ground.
But you and Superman gave them their 15 minutes,
That's right. They got their
right?
15 minutes of
Oh,
fame, and in an alternate universe, the fire's out because Superman put it out.
right. That's a great story. In 2017, I believe, Batman Arkham, the Joker's daughter, came out. Can you tell us about that?
The miniseries that was not Duella Dent,
Oh,
or
really?
it was,
Okay.
if it was Duella Dent, it's not the Duella Dent I created. This was
Right.
a crazed person who actually peeled skin off somebody else and put it on her face.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Yeah, so it was a totally different character. What I found interesting was that they put it together in a trade paperback book with my original Joker's Daughter stories, and it's like,
Okay.
this is not the same audience.
Right.
What I was writing back in the late 1970s does not jibe with what you're doing in 2017. But they sent me royalties, so that's fine with me.
Silver linings.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you want to reprint my stuff? That's fine. I'll get a check.
So that leads me into some of your characters have been written by other people. What are your feelings on how those characters' directions have gone?
Well, the abuse that poor Duella Dent got over the years, depending on who was writing her, was sometimes amusing and sometimes annoying. But like everything else, it's DC's property. It's not mine. And I mean, just as I got to do things with Superman and Batman, characters that I didn't create, next generations of writers and artists can do what they want to do. There was a brief reintroduction of Mr. E that was a similar kind of thing where they just made him a crazed lunatic who was thought he was fighting evil and wasn't, and was like, well, this isn't the character that I created. So,
I read a little bit about that in my research. It was completely different from what you had originally started. It gave him a backstory though, which was unfortunate how he
Yes, it
became
was.
blind.
Yes. I mean, we used to when I was when we were creating the thing, I used the line from the Simon and Garfunkel song. It was blinded by the light of God and truth and right. And that was why he could see evil. And
Much nicer.
it was a much nicer, thing. And it was like, all right, well, the whole that we never explained, but the backstory was somehow he came face to face with God. And that was how he got the power to see evil, but he couldn't see anything else. We never really got into an origin for him.
That would have been a nicer way for me to have lost my sight, but what do you think about some of the origin changes of some of the bigger comic characters over the years?
I think some of the stuff is, added to it. I think some of them, they just like, okay, why did you need to do this? Some of the backstories that they've come up with for what was, Krypton and Why was Superman sent to Earth? And it's just like, nah, you don't need to do this. I one of the ones that I really didn't like was the Superman movie, in which Jonathan Kent, rather than having a heart attack, is, I think it was Kevin Costner was playing Jonathan at the time. There was the tornado, and Jonathan goes to let the dog out of the car, and then Clark is standing there, and Jonathan doesn't want him to come and save him. And it's like, this makes no sense. I mean, the whole concept of Superman losing his parents is that he can't prevent it. He couldn't prevent Krypton from exploding, and that's how he lost his birth parents. And then the origin of, or the death of Ma Pa Kent that I read in the 60s that was done, was they both contracted a disease, and there was no cure for it, a tropical fever, and they both died of that. And then when they came up with the idea with the first Superman movie that Jonathan has a heart attack, it's the same thing. This is something Superman cannot prevent. It's like, there are things that are out of your control, no matter how super you are. But here's a situation where all he had to hit super speed, he could race over, bring Jonathan back, and everybody was, how did he get here? But no, we're going to stand there and watch him, be swept away by the tornado. It was just like, no, this is stupid.
I don't disagree. Do you still read comics today?
Mostly older stuff. The current superhero stuff, I just can't get into. It's too complex, and there's no complete stories anymore. When I was describing how this the comics were done, you had an 8-page story or a 6-page story or a 12, whatever. And it was a story. I mean, if I went into Julie and said, well, this is going to be part 7 of this ongoing thing, and he'd be like, no, it's not. You're going to tell a story, and it's going to have a beginning and a middle and an end, and however many pages you have, that's what's going to happen. And when I was writing them, what I actually do after I broke it down is I would make little thumbnail boxes of each page, and I would just write little notes to myself as, this, 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 so that when I got to the end of the story, I finished the story. And when I was laying and breaking it down, if I still had stuff to do, it's like, I got to go back and condense or cut something. Or if I got there and it was like, oh, I still got two more pages, I better go back and put something in, kind of thing. But now that, there's just too many crossovers and too many continued stories. And it's gotten to the point where early on, when they started doing continued stories, like, oh, it'll get condensed, put together as a trade paperback book. So a 7 or 8 issue story would be a 160-page trade paperback. But now the stories are so long, even the trade paperbacks aren't complete stories. So it's volume one of 6 volumes to tell this story that is, 48 issues long. And it's like, you better have a hell of a lot of plot going on in here.
My stepdaughter reads a, I guess it's a manga comic, and it's got like 2,000 issues
Oh
to
yeah,
it.
they go on forever and ever. I have my students in my class, their final project is a presentation. They have to do two pick two graphic novels and do a presentation on them. And invariably, because there are so many graphic novels out there now, I end up with half a dozen or more that I haven't read or haven't heard of. And so every April and November, I'm sending the library a list of, oh, I need this and I want this and I want that. And so I'm currently working through the most recent classes assortment of graphic novels that they chose to review. This group seemed to lean more to manga, and it's like, okay, this is the first chapter, and there's 483 more. And it's like, no, I'm not reading all of this.
I will skim.
I'll read the first one, and if it has any interest, I'll go on to the second. But The variety of graphic novels that are available now is and being done now is far greater and a far wider thing. And I mean, that's one of the things I really like about teaching the class is finding out about, oh, I should read this, or I think I'll like that. And some of them I read and I'm like, no. And there's others, it's like, oh, this is really well done. So,
Now, for a time, you were known as the Answer Man.
yes.
How did you get that moniker, and what was it all about?
When I started working as the assistant production manager, I was also the proofreader. So I was reading everything that before it went through the production end and got published. And I came up with the idea that what if we had a weekly page that promoted the 8 or 10 books that were coming out that week? And what better way to do that than as a newspaper page? And what better newspaper than the Daily Planet?
Of course.
And so I mocked up a Daily Planet front page and highlighted one of the stories was the lead story, the whatever issue it was going to be the lead, and then a couple of others, and the just and they're just a checklist of here's the other books that are on sale this week. And I took it to Sol Harrison and I said, what do you think of this as a weekly kind of thing? And he said, yeah, I like it. Go ahead. And at that point, I think Sol thought that the editors were going to keep an eye on what I was doing. And the editors all thought Sol was keeping an eye on what I was doing. And in fact, nobody was keeping an eye on what I was doing. I was just doing it. And so I started doing the Daily Planet pages on a weekly basis. And I did some mini puzzles as a feature because I wanted something more than just the hype columns, and did a couple of other gossip kind of things. And then I came up with the idea of, well, how about the answer man answering questions? Because I would get a lot of the mail that would come in, they'd give to me because they knew I was the trivia nut and I'd waste the time spending a card back to a kid saying, oh, here's the answer to your question. And so I started running the Answer Man column as one of the little features in the Daily Planet page. And after a month or so, I said, well, one of the things I liked when I was writing letters, I mean, the reason I got the job here was my name was in the comic books. So why don't I start printing the names of the kids who send in the questions? And so I started running their names. And all of a sudden, the readers figured out, oh, I could get my question published in the Answer Man column. And it got to the point where I got more mail on any given day than all of the editors combined, all of these letters sent to the Answer Man. And the Answer Man column became bigger. And then we started doing separate Answer Man pages as a separate from the Daily Planet because there were just so many questions. And of course, all this time, as I said, the editors thought Saul was watching what I was doing, and Saul thought the editors were watching, and here I am, I'm just creating pages,
And
and
getting
it's
bigger
like
and bigger.
it's getting this whole thing is growing. And so, I mean, I had quite a bit of knowledge about the books, and I had access to the DC library, so I could go look things up. And Nelson Bridwell also being, an expert on the stuff. If I was something I was really stumped with, I said, Nelson, was there a point where Batman pulled a gun? And Nelson had a photographic memory. So he could go and pull out the book, open it up, point at the panel, and say, there it is. And be like, okay. Thank you. So, and then that just kept growing. The whole concept of the Answer Man. So, I mean, for like 8 or 9 years, there were Answer Man columns, and it became my alternate persona.
Would you ever want to revise it?
Well, at this point, there's almost 30 years of comics I don't know much about. So, ask me about the Golden Age and the Silver Age and the Bronze Age, but not going much further than that.
So you got the chance to collaborate with your wife, Lori, I believe on some of the comics itself, but also on the Complete Idiot's Guide to Office Politics. What was that experience like?
Well, Lori likes to call herself the queen of the idiots because she wrote, I think, 17 idiots, complete idiots guides. And everything from creative writing to spelling to dealing with in-laws, etc. And when they came up with they wanted to do one on office politics, and they said, well, you're a college professor, what kind of office politics? And she said, yes, but my husband is production director in a division of Warner Communications. And so they said, oh, okay, so you can collaborate on it. And she wrote most of the book.
Right.
I provided stories, you know, when it was like, oh, I need a story about it. And I, oh, well, yeah, we had this happen, or we had that happen. But she was the one who did most of the book. The few times where she got co-writer credit on stories, it was the opposite. It was just like, oh, I need a woman's point of view on how this would work. And so what would you do in this situation kind of thing? And
okay.
So, and that's really the way it worked.
That sounds pretty cool though.
Yeah. We stuck with our own skill sets and, you know, contributed to the other.
Now tell us about, you have a novel out that I just found out about recently, The Junkyards of Memory. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I wrote that in the mid 90s.
Okay.
And it was basically, it's about a guy who 25 years after he graduates from high school realizes that he's lost touch with his closest friends and decides he's got to track them down and find out, you know, why they are no longer in contact with one another.
Okay.
You know, he had gone through his own trauma that basically made him lose contact with the others. But as he's tracking down, he realizes that none of them are talking to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And so it tracks the different, as he tracks down the different people and then realizes and puts together all the pieces and realize what happened.
Mm-hmm. Is it a mystery or is it a horror?
It's mostly a mystery
kind of. Okay. You know,
but
can we still get our hands on it?
Yeah, it's still available at Amazon.
Okay. I'm gonna track that one down too.
Yeah.
Because what I read about it, it sounded really interesting.
Uh-huh.
How different is it to write for a comic than for a full-length book?
It was a difficult thing because I think more in pictures than I do in words.
Okay.
So it made it very interesting, very easy for me to write comic books because I can envision what the panels would be. And so when I go back and I look at the novel, it's like, I don't really ever describe any of the characters. You know, what do they look like?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, I guess I should have, but I know what they look like in my head. So,
right.
You know, and I'm used to, you know, writing comic book stories where it's like, well, I know what Superman, everybody knows what Superman looks like. So mm-hmm. I just say Superman did this, or Clark Kent did this, or Lois did that. You know, and I don't have to describe anything unless there's some specific thing that they're wearing or, you know, holding or something like that.
Right.
So it was a very different kind of thing. As far as writing books, the other book that I did is The Secret History of AA Comics.
Okay.
Which is basically an alternate history of the comic book industry.
Interesting.
Max Gaines, back in the 40s, owned the All-American Comics division of DC. And they published Flash and Green Lantern and Wonder Woman. The DC side had Superman and Batman. And Max and his partners, as Bill, they had separate offices. The AA offices were downtown and the DC offices were uptown. And the partners were Harry Donenfeld and Jack Liebowitz. And as Bill Gaines, who was Max's son, described it, every afternoon, his father would take the subway uptown and three of them would fight. And finally, Max got to the point where he said, look, either you buy me out or I'll buy you out, because we can't keep doing this. And so Donenfeld and Liebowitz bought out Max and the AA division was incorporated into the DC brand.
Okay.
And then he went off and started EC Comics, which was initially educational and then became entertaining comics.
Okay.
And Max was killed in a boating accident,
Oh.
and Bill ended up having to take over the company in 1947. And Bill didn't like the stuff. His father was publishing picture stories from the Bible and comics aimed at the youngest readers, like Tiny Tot comics. And Bill said, if
Okay.
I'm going to run this company, we're going to publish stuff that I want to read,
Right.
and created the crime comics and the horror comics. And that was the stuff that he was doing. So what I did was I took that point where Max says to Donenfeld and Leibowitz, you buy me out or I buy you out, and flipped it. And
Okay.
so now it's AA Comics becomes the company that has all the characters. And that instead of Green Lantern and Flash fading away in the late 40s into the early 50s, it's Superman and Batman that fade away. And so when Julie Schwartz says we want to recreate the superheroes, instead of creating a new Flash, he creates a new Superman.
Superman.
And so the whole history goes where everything that is Superman and Batman over the course of our real history is now Flash and Green Lantern, right up to, the Superman TV show of the 50s is actually Green Lantern, and the
Right.
Batman show of the 60s is the Flash,
Okay.
and the when they the Superman movie of 1978 becomes a Green Lantern movie. And so the whole history is flipped.
That would change my life around too,
Yeah.
That sounds very interesting.
So it was a lot of fun, and there were things that I put in there that my wife says, there's going to be a point sometime in the future where people are going to think that's what really happened. And I said, yeah, probably.
What would
So,
you
but
say you are most proud of professionally?
most proud of professionally, that's a toughie. Just, I think the overall, the amount of stuff that I was able to do, and the little pieces and big pieces I contributed to the history of the various characters.
Right.
I think my favorite Superman stories were, I did a 4-issue series called The Secret Years, and it
Okay.
was about Clark Kent's college time. I mean, Superboy stories had been appearing, since the late 1940s. And basically, Superboy's history ends when he leaves Smallville. He
Right.
graduates high school and he goes to college. And then Superman stories begin when Clark is working at the Daily Planet. So there's the four-year period in between where there were maybe half a dozen stories done over the course of 50 years of Superman that were devoted to anything that went on in his college days. And so I went to Julie and I said, how about a series of stories, that take place in college with Clark at Hudson at Metropolis University? And so we came up with a group of his friends, and initially it ran as a backup series in Superman. We had a number of Superman stories, the Superboy becoming Superman.
Right.
And then the 4-issue miniseries focuses on his junior year and the defining moment where he decides he's not Superboy anymore, he's Superman.
Right.
So, but I played a lot on the whole concept of he was not able to save his Kryptonian parents. He was not able to save Jonathan and Martha Kent.
Right.
And that sometimes he has to make the sacrifice and accept that he can't do something, but do something else of the greater good. And
Right.
so in the series, I introduced a precursor basically to Jimmy Olsen, who is, knows that Clark is Superman or Superboy and keeps it a secret, but also counts on him to come and help him whenever there's an issue.
Right.
And the character Billy ends up in a situation that is a life or death situation, but Superman is busy saving an entire island of people from a tsunami. And so this is where Superman, you know, he decides, he realizes, I can't do everything.
Right.
And decides Superboy would have done that, but Superman has to do this. So.
I can see that becoming a TV series.
Yeah.
I really can. I'm surprised it hasn't already.
Yeah, well, I'm also surprised that they haven't taken that and you know turned it into a 90-part story now.
Exactly.
When I was writing Teen Titans, I did the origin of the Teen Titans in one 18-page story. And about 10 or 12 years later, somebody redid it, and it took 6 issues. And I was like, there's nothing else in here. I did all this in one 18-page story.
Yep.
So. But
So I always like to finish off the interview segment by asking the question, is there a question you wish I had asked, but I didn't?
well, I told you about the secret history, so I think that would have been
Right.
the thing that you should have asked about this.
Yep, you beat me to
Yeah,
the punch.
I can't think of anything else.
All right, that's good.
Yeah.
We're not done.
Okay.
I have prepared a rapid fire game of would you rather questions, and I like to
Okay.
call it Page Turner.
Okay.
So, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Would you rather have the ability to fly or have super speed?
Super speed.
Okay, why?
Because I could get places faster. Flying is like nice, but I'd rather be able to get someplace faster. Actually, I'll go off on one of
Sure.
the first assignments I do in my class is we make a list of superpowers. Okay, we go around the room and it's like, you know, name a superpower, name another, and everybody come, we come
Right.
up with a list of maybe 25 powers. And their assignment is pick one, tell me why you picked it. And if you woke up tomorrow morning and had it, what would you do with it?
Okay.
And the example I always give them is I had a girl 1 year and she said, well, I'd like to be invisible. And I said, why? She says, because I think my boyfriend's cheating on me and I'd like to follow him around. And if he is, I'm really going to screw him up. And I said, okay, that makes sense. The power that I picked, though, is teleportation. Because it's even better than super speed. Because you know, I mean,
Right.
my son and daughter-in-law and grandson live in Jersey City. My daughter lives in Colorado, so it would be very nice to just go like that and be able to
Yep.
go visit. So,
I would go with X-ray vision because that would imply that would actually have vision.
yeah, that
So
makes sense.
I'll go
Okay.
that route. Would you rather be the strongest hero or the most dangerous villain?
Oh, strongest hero. Absolutely.
Okay.
It's one of the things at DC was always, they were always the Superman people and the Batman people. And you either side, you if Superman was your favorite or Batman was your favorite. And I was always, Superman was always my favorite.
Right.
And I said, he is a, he realizes he has these powers, but he has to use them to help other people. And I always said, Batman just wants to beat up criminals.
Right.
Batman wants revenge. His criminals killed his parents. He wants to punch every criminal in the face.
Yep.
I said, Superman says, I got these powers. I should be able to use them for something.
Very good. Would you rather be the sidekick to Amazing Man or Mr. E?
I'd rather be the sidekick to Amazing Man.
Okay.
I think it would be much more entertaining.
A little less dangerous too.
Oh yeah. How much danger can you get in a neighborhood in Queens? Yeah. Where there are no demons and devils and devil dogs from
Exactly.
hell.
Exactly. Would you rather pilot Wonder Woman's invisible jet or drive the Batmobile?
I'd rather drive the Batmobile. I never understood the concept of Wonder Woman's invisible. What's the point of having an invisible plane when you can see her sitting in
You
it?
can see her sitting there, yep.
It's like, look, Wonder Woman is sitting on something flying around in the sky. It's like, why?
And the last one,
Mm-hmm.
would you rather accessorize with Green Lantern's ring or Superman's red boots?
A Green Lantern's ring, sure.
Okay.
Because I could do stuff with it.
Yes.
Yeah. Never really liked boots anyway.
They can be uncomfortable.
Yeah. I think the question really should be Green Lantern's ring or Tony Stark's Iron Man suit.
Okay, I was trying to keep it DC.
That's all right.
Okay, but on your question, what would you pick?
I would still pick Green Lantern's ring.
Okay.
So,
This was a lot of fun.
yeah.
Fascinating and interesting stuff. I appreciate you venturing beyond the rotunda.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Bob Rozakis. I am looking forward to reading his books, The Junkyards of Memory and The Secret History of AA Comics. Maybe I will record a review afterwards. Fun fact, you can get Bob Rozakis' autograph by simply coming to the Farmingdale Public Library, where he serves as a resident notary public. Just bring some sort of legal document with you. Once again, I wish everyone a happy new year. I thank Bob Rozakis for sitting down and talking with me. As always, I thank Maxile for our music, and Natalie and Brendan for editing and production. And I thank our growing listening community. We really do appreciate the support. Please continue to follow and subscribe and share us with your family and friends. I will talk with you next month with a new episode. Until then, be well and enjoy wandering the stacks.